This morning, I was discussing various aspects of what might be called the religion of no religion, considering religion as a raft for crossing a river, or rather, religion in the sense of dharma, not so much the doctrine as the method, considering it as the raft for crossing a river, as the brick for knocking at a door, as a medicine to cure a sickness, which when it's worked, you get rid of. And I was showing you that this in the Far East culminated in a type of life, a way of life, where to some very large extent the outward symptoms of religiousness disappear, especially in the art forms, where the icon ceases to be the figure of the holy person or the deity or whatever, and becomes simply a flowering branch, a rock, flowing water, clouds, birds, and funny little old men. You know, a curious thing goes on in the whole world of religious practice. And that is, the older a religion gets, the more the distance of time lends such eminence to its original founders that they become superhumanized, and the practice of the religion that they founded becomes sort of derived of power. It just sinks into going through the motions, because people say, well, we're living in a decadent age. In the past there were these great heroes who did all these marvelous things, Buddha and Jesus and Confucius and all their great followers. But today everybody is rotten, and nobody can expect to get more than a little way. I had a friend who went to India. He was an astonishing fellow, because he was earnest. He would do anything. He was full of the power of self-discipline. And he put himself under an Indian master who came to this country in the first place, and he became a vegetarian, and he practiced yoga every day, and he was determined to get that thing. So finally his teacher told him the best place he could go to in India. And off he went, and he joined a yoga school. There was a whole faculty, and everybody was practicing yoga, and he was so earnest and he was so devoted that within 4 weeks he could do everything that the other students could do, and they'd been there maybe 2 or 3 years. And so when he got to that, he mastered all the physical postures and the breathing exercises and the concentration exercises. And so he said to one of the older students, now, what about real samadhi? Do you get that around here? And the student said, no, none of us have got it yet. You better ask the teachers. So he began asking around the members of the faculty, what about samadhi? Do you get this? Well, they said, no, not yet. Well, he said, I'm willing, he said, to spend any amount of time here. I don't have to get back. I've got just enough funds to get by, and so I'm willing to do anything you tell me, to practice with all my heart. Can you do any of you have samadhi? They said, well, no, not yet. Does anybody? Can you direct me to someone who does have it? Well, I said, about 125 years ago there was someone who was really considered to have had it. And so then he began to think, why is it then that when the members of the faculty come out of their meditation period, they all look as if they just had a good sleep? You see? There begins to always grow up the concept of a golden age. There are our forefathers, they really knew how to do it. But today, everything's falling apart. Do you know, people have been saying that for centuries. There is an Egyptian text on the panels of some pyramid, temple or whatnot, 6,000 years old, in which an Egyptian priest is complaining that everybody's falling apart. So, the lesson of this is, everybody here has just as much capacity as Buddha had. Nobody, who was Buddha's teacher? Think about that. Who psychoanalyzed Freud? Somebody has to start. And so everybody has the potentiality of being the first one. So I call this problem the distance of excessive reverence. It has the disadvantage, you see, of making all these problems that we're discussing and states of consciousness that I've been talking about. It makes them seem impossibly remote, as if they were something attainable only by a very, very favored few. And that's a very frustrating attitude to get. We were discussing this morning the sense that people have when they read Zen literature, that the thing is just round the corner. I just almost was on it. See, that's a much more healthy attitude than that, oh, this thing will require many, many years of practice. Now, it so often turns out, you know, that the person who feels that it's just round the corner will feel this way for many years. Only, he won't be put off by the idea of many, many years work yet to do. But will always, in the feeling that it's always, almost instantly available, his interest will be maintained for an extraordinarily long time. Thinking of how much work there is to be done just puts some people out of commission. You know, you've got to answer a lot of letters, and they've stacked up and stacked up and stacked up. It's an appalling pile. And eventually everything gets so complicated that you're inclined to take the whole bunch of correspondence and throw it in the fire. But if you have to answer it, for some reason or other, you can only answer it one letter at a time. Same way with washing dishes. When they pile up on the drying board, and you get this mountain of dishes, and you think, oh, I've got to go through that. I've done it before, I've got to do it again this afternoon, and for year in and year out I can see all those dishes I've got to wash in the future, and lo and behold, the pile of dishes on the draining board grows higher and higher in your mind's eye until it's absolutely overwhelming. And you say, well, maybe some super dishwasher, some kitchen maid of the past who was a great hero, would undertake this sort of life. But poor little me, I can't do that sort of thing. Whereas the only way to wash them is one by one, as if each one was the only one you had to wash. That's obvious. So, don't be discouraged by this attitude that you find so commonly among Asian peoples, in their feeling about Buddhism and Hinduism, that it's something so great that it's only cut out for very few supermen. Don't let that put you off. It may be true statistically, when you review the vast, vast multitude of human beings that there are, but so likewise, from a statistical point of view, this group of you gathered here, and maybe some comparable groups dotted around the country in various places, constitute a tiny, tiny fragment of the total population. And I suppose some external observer could say, of you, rare, rare indeed are the people who are interested enough in all this to give it, you know, a weekend's thought even. But from your own subjective standpoint, you're not a statistic. You're not one of a special elect few, such that you've joined a secret society and have become self-conscious about it. You may be, from a certain point of view, one of an elect few, but from your own point of view, you're just your own direct, perfectly straightforward self, with no particular claims to fame or whatever it may be. So don't be put off by the distance of excessive reverence when it comes to all these things. Well, now, I want to take a further step in getting across the idea of thusness. I made already some mention of looking at words as if they were things that had no meaning, but were just noises, but interesting noises, just as the shape of a leaf is an interesting shape. Now, consider first of all the shape of a leaf. It's something that goes like this, you see. And it's green, you know, and it floats on a tree. And it is a method whereby the tree absorbs moisture. And there are all sorts of people who will want to say to you, you see, really, a leaf is a very rational thing. It exists so that the tree can absorb moisture, and they can go on describing it, and you see all the wonderful ways in which this little leaf works as a kind of a moisture-absorbing, breathing thing. And you say, yes, by Jove, isn't that great? That's very rational. Marvelous thing a tree is. And yet when you consider that the object of the leaf is to absorb certain things that are necessary for the maintenance of the tree, then you must ask the next question, look at the tree as a whole, standing there, bushy and bright, and you say, well, what's that for? Well, I mean, what purpose is served by the tree? Well, people say it has something to do with the oxygen in the atmosphere, and if there aren't any trees around, you see, human beings and animals, higher animals, can't live. They need trees and they need plants. So, taking it back again, the shape of the leaf then is interpreted as having something to do with the maintenance of me. Well, naturally then that's very important. It serves a function. It's a good leaf, see? But then let's ask a few deeper questions. We looked at the tree and said, well, you're an entertaining and funny shape, what are you for? And it said, well, I serve mankind. All right, now let's look at a human being and say, you're a funny shape sitting around here. What on earth do you think you're doing? I mean, you're surviving, you're eating things up. But what for? And then you really have to think. Oh, yes, I remember now, you say. I'm for the boss. There's a system going on, and the lower things serve the higher things, and there are something higher than us, there are angels above us, and then above all the angels there's God, and we serve God. Oh, and that's the meaning of human life, to serve God. All right, now what's God for? See? There he is, sitting up in heaven. However you want to interpret God, whether you want to interpret God in a primitive way, as an old gentleman, kindly disposed, very powerful, clothed in the skies, upon the golden throne, surrounded by all the angels, playing those harps I told you about. You know, the angel's harp is the entire spectrum of physical possibilities. You know, from cosmic rays to hard X-rays on the other end, or whatever it is. I'm not a physicist. But that's the harp of the angel, and the Lord God clothed with the skies, there they all are sitting in heaven. And they're looking at him and saying, well, Lord, you're the most beautiful thing we ever saw. You're the answer. But why? See, what's he for? Well, they agreed. They sat around there for a long time, and they said, really, Lord, we look at you, and we decided you aren't for anything. You don't need to be. You don't serve any purpose, because you're it. You're there. You've arrived. See? So what do you do when you're there? What does the Lord do, you see? I mean, I think you'll understand my figurative language. Well, he glows. And everybody sits around that glow and they say, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. Thy glory, thy Shekinah, thy jazz. That's what it's all about. Now, you see, you can derive a lot of things from that. You can say, look, everybody, as if this were God talking, look, everybody, I have this big thing going, and I want you to share it. But there are conditions. In order to share it, you must love me. But you can't love me unless I give you the capacity to do so. But if I give you the capacity to love me, you get at the same time the capacity to hate me, or to love yourself instead. So from that, you see, we set up a whole pattern of game rules in which you think like this, oh dear me, you know, I ought to get that thing, that love of God. That's terribly serious. I ought to get that, because if I don't get that, I haven't made it. I haven't got the purpose of the whole creation. And that's terribly difficult to do. But what then when you get it? What then? Suddenly the whole thing changes. And it's no longer this awful kind of thing, will I or won't I? Am I good or am I guilty? Am I saint or am I sinner? Then suddenly, at the end of it all, the Christian sees that what he was being invited to, you know, was a party in heaven where they could all sit around and go like this, because that's great, you see, the vibrations. They do it forever. Just like children like to throw stones into a pond and watch the waves go out. Or like birds will sit all through twilight and sing and sing and sing, no hurry, repeating the same themes, sometimes with subtle little variations and so on. They just sit and they sing. So you see, always, when you get down to the bottom of anything, and you say, what's that for? What's that for? You're finally going to get to a point where somebody says, well, I just like to make a noise. I can't explain it, it has no purpose, but I saved my money for years. I bought an insurance policy. I did everything purposefully just so that I could finally sit down and make this noise. Oh, I mean, you may like to smoke cigars, sit in a rocker on the porch, and smell the smell of that smoke. See? You may think that that's very decadent and that you ought to be working for others, that you ought to be giving, raising funds so that there shouldn't be anybody underprivileged. And when you've raised the funds and you've given all that money away to the poor, what are the poor going to do? They've got to find some other poor. They're going to give that, they're going to work for. But then when they've worked for those, and they're all right, and everybody's all right, what are they going to do? Why, they're going to sit on the porch and they smoke a big cigar. Now this has become a serious problem. Because it's highly possible that we're entering into an age of automation in which it's not going to be necessary to work. accept, I mean, if you want gravy, it's going to be yes. But if you want simply to have the basic necessities for survival, the advanced food and medicine and so on that a technological society can produce, you won't have to do a thing. We will move into an age when all that will be, practically speaking, for free, because the machines will earn the money for us, and we'll get paid for it. And people will say, well, now, a human being, well, we've always felt before, you don't have any right to live unless you're productive. You must work, you must produce something. That's why it's always been difficult for a literary man. If you're a farmer, then you know you're serving the community. If you're a fisherman, even if you're a grocer, you know you're doing something useful. But if you're a poet, you begin to get a guilty conscience. Shouldn't I have been a farmer? So on. But so always, though, when you follow it through, when the farmer gets the milk to the baby drinks the milk, goes blah, 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 absorbs this milk, and gets bigger. Finally, it comes to be a man. The man does all these things. He gets all this food, and he sends it around, and he makes more people, and he feeds them all. And they say, thank you so much for feeding us. We're doing well. But he may say, well, so what? What's it all about? I mean, it looks as if I've sometimes suggested that all we are is an elaborate system of tubes. And the object of these tubes is to put things in at one end and let them out at the other, and enjoy that. Enjoy it so much that you like other tubes, and you make connections with those tubes in such a way that you get more tubes. Now, these tubes have ganglia at each end, at the top end, called a brain. And the point of that ganglion is to be a very sensitive, cunning little thing that finds out where there are things to eat. So they keep reproducing each other, and so the whole of life becomes the flow of a stuff through a tube. Get that through, and get it going faster, get more of it going through, get more of it, and don't let it foul the things up as it goes through. Everything as it goes through a tube tends to wear the tube out. So the tube tries not to be worn out by the stuff going through it, so as to keep the sensation going on. Now the tubes, when they are through with eating, and they are satisfied in that way, they are going to play other games, just to keep things interesting. And so slowly they invent civilization, and they invent literature and music and painting, and they do all this thing, you see, because when you go off to the evening, you've done your day's work, you've eaten your dinner, I hope not out of too much of a sense of duty, well, then what? Well, there are so many things you can do. You can go to the concert, where they will make all kinds of complicated noises. And you'll say, my, listen to that, you know? So that you'll be able to get that feeling of being astounded. What fantastically complicated noises are made here. Or you go dancing. And when you go dancing, you see, you go chitter, 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 all over the room. You see? Jiggle, 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 jiggle. Complicated jiggle, see? Even beautiful jiggle, but basically jiggle. And that's what that led up to. So you see, the more you think about it, about what all this work is for, why we are campaigning for this and for that, to get world peace, to get recognition for Negroes, to get this, that, and the other, what do we all want everybody to do? And so when the Negroes get their recognition, then what are they going to do? Well, they're going to gather together, and they're going to go, hoo-ja-doo-ja-doo-ja-boo-ba-hoo-ja-boo, and do all sorts of things like that, because that's great. But you must see, therefore, the whole world as that sort of a thing ultimately. When you finally get down to it, it likes to make noises, it likes to blow bubbles, it likes to dance in a ring, and that's what it's all about. Look at it still another way. Supposing I use words to refer to a certain situation, which happens to be the situation of some trees growing near my front gate. Now, this form of life I can refer to, and I say, here are trees, and you understand what I mean. The word tree is meaningful, and my being able to point out the tree to you, you know I'm making sense. We all agree about the word. But now look at the situation from a slightly higher point of view. Here is a creature that goes to another creature and says, tree. The other creature understands. And we've set up a form of life between us now, which includes the tree and you and I, and we've all referred to it, and we've got the communication method we understand about it. Now see this whole situation that I'm now describing as a form of life, which a form of goings-on, which is something in its own turn, just like the tree growing. Well, there it is. What does that mean? And you finally see, well, it really doesn't have to mean anything. It's just that we say, good morning. Aren't those beautiful trees at my front gate? Say, yes, they are. Come around here and look at them from the other side. How wonderful they are against the sky. Isn't that great? Now, we've made sense to each other, but I ask again, what does it mean that we make sense to each other? It is a playful activity. It is a going on. It is a performance. Just like the tree is a performance that does this and this and this and this and this with all its branches and leaves. And that absorbs things and so on. And then it drops seeds so that it can go on. And other ones can do this and this and this and this. And they can drop seeds and go on and do so and so and so and so. Now, you have to be very careful at this point, because you may go absolutely stark, staring crazy. At this point, some people get the horrors. And they suddenly see the whole performance of this human race as nothing but automatic gyrations. They see, here are these mechanisms all sitting around here, and they're saying, we're human. Good morning, good afternoon, we're here, isn't this nice, etc. And you can suddenly get the horrid feeling that they all are just so much wiggly, protoplasmic hullabaloo that goes through the motions of being alive. In other words, if you insult one of them or you hurt one of them, they get on a pained expression. But you can get to the crazy point of regarding that as nothing more than the fact when you hit water with a stone, it goes splash. Naturally, a person gets on a pained expression when they're hurt. But that's all it is. Then there are certain tensions inside that being. They may be very acute tensions. They may be rather slight. But it's just tensions going on inside. There's nothing to worry about. And so you can suddenly get the awful feeling that you are surrounded by nothing but senseless process. And so when people sometimes do get that feeling, they lose all their compassion, they lose all their morals, they go entirely to pieces, and they feel they can exploit everybody in any situation in all directions. And so there's a sort of a hairline difference between that and a vision which is very much the same. Very much the same. But instead of being a kind of a thing you put down by saying, well, it's just a lot of behavior. That's all it is. You say, good heavens, think of that. You know, it's not so bad after all. For example, there are many, many situations of physical or moral pain of which we are very frightened. And it's largely, we are frightened of them because we have been taught that these are bad for us. You see, there are some children who are thought of as schizophrenic, sometimes the Mongolian idiot, doesn't really have, he's in a situation where he cannot absorb adult judgments about happenings. So he really doesn't care if he gets run over in the street. He's not interested in adult life goals. And so a Mongolian idiot type of child, you can get on with them wonderfully, provided you never cross them. If they do something you don't want them to do, change the subject, interest them in something else, but never say no. Because they roll with anything. You know, if he suddenly wants to strike the matches and light the house on fire, you go up to him and say, "Bleh, whoops!" And he gets so interested, he looks at that and says, "Wow!" And you're off. And if you want to pay attention, you can play with a child like that for ages, because they'll do anything. They'll sit down at table, and they'll get interested in bread and jam, and they'll pick it up like that, and drop it on the plate, and splash the jam all over the place. They'll make figures in it. They're always absolutely fascinated. But they're way out. They won't do what we want them to do. Well, we say, you're idiots, because they have a head shape different from ours. And they've got another idea about life. But it doesn't really follow that they're idiots. I mean, in a bad sense. They're living on different lines. They've got a different game. But so we have some a little bit thing to learn from them. That they don't go in for all this business about giving life meaning and arranging it in certain patterns about which you get compulsive. They just go with it as it comes. So their point of view is apparently then quite different from the person to whom the thing is a rattling monstrosity of meaninglessness. This, of course, is liable to be the person who reacts that way against an overdose of insistence that life be meaningful and that a child behave sensibly and orderly and in accordance with some domineering adult's game. When he sees that all that doesn't necessarily hold together, he's apt to get a bad reaction. But now to get back to this thing, when the adult who has got his program and is pushing the child through it, supposing a child vomits, overate something or other, the milk was bad, the adult teaches the child that the sensation of vomiting is disgusting, because the adult goes bleh, see, and makes the child feel that in addition to vomiting, he ought to feel disgusted by it. And that makes a complication. All right? So when the adult hurts the child, pinches it, has a doctor stick a hypodermic into it, or something has to be done, then there's a sensation of pain. But when mother sees the child stuck with the needle, and she goes, you know, or something, this doesn't help the child at all. The child feels that in addition to screeching, reacting, or jumping to the pain, it also has to go about it, you see? Because mother did. Or if the child feels like crying, crying is a shameful thing to do. You mustn't cry. So the child, in addition to having the cry thing, has to have the shame about the cry thing. And you see, that sets up reactions to reactions to reactions on different levels inside us, whereby all these complicated problems begin. Think, for example, about the way we humans die. It's just terrible. We sweep ourselves under the carpet. We don't let death be an important thing, really. Because look at what we do to die. Death is terribly important. Just as important as being born or getting married. But death is something that we can't allow, because it is a flat contradiction of our image of ourselves. So instead of dying in a riotous and glorious way, we get shuffled off to hospitals where everything is kind of, yeah, well, good intentioned indeed, but it's kind of, the doctors don't know what to do when people die, because doctors are supposed to cure you. They can't help you die, therefore they are out of role when that happens. And so their whole attitude to your death is, oh, I'm so sorry, this is dreadfully unfortunate. It's too bad. Well, it isn't necessarily too bad. Maybe a very good thing. They used to say with mothers in childbirth, you know, that this is a dreadful pain that you've got to go through, because it's your punishment for eating that fruit of the tree in the beginning of time. You are a daughter of Eve, and therefore you suffer. Very good for you. And so everybody got these big ideas about the pains of labor, until some doctors came along and said, let's invent some new language and re-hypnotize these patients in another way and call it contractions instead of pains. And this made things simpler for many women. Not all women, a lot of them simply not going to be convinced at all that they oughtn't to hurt like blazes. So but when those who are convinced suddenly realize that this so-called pain is a sort of orgasm you can have, the attitude is a lot better. Well, let's get another revolution. Instead of talking about the pangs and the pains of death, let's give them a new name. You know, the ecstasy of disappearing. I'm serious, you may laugh, but The thing is that all those sensations have been in a social context where they're interpreted negatively. And so everybody, when you're having them, they say, oh dear me, oh dear, that's awful. We're so sorry for you, and we're going to give you a pill to take away the pain, and that's all right, you know. But it's not so much the pill, it's the attitude of saying, oh dear, isn't it awful, you're going to die. Well, is it? I mean, it's very difficult because we've all been so thoroughly indoctrinated about this. And we feel, I mean, I remember all through my childhood the way that my peer group and all the literature we read played up death. The image of the skull, the ghosts, the shrieking horrors in the dark, the graveyard, the tolling bell, the bats, the shroud, you know, and all this hocus pocus making this, you know, a grisly scene, so that everybody interprets the basic sensations that are involved in this in a highly charged, overloaded fashion. So then, when the cat dies, it dies with great dignity. A sick cat disappears, especially if it's out in country, and it curls up in the grass and dies. The birds, they drop off the trees. I remember Ibram Lassar describing a dying gull on the beach near Montauk. This bird looked and looked and looked into the sun. And as the sun went down, the bird looked and looked and followed the heat light of that sun until there was nothing left. And it shivered and died. Very dignified. But human beings aren't allowed to die like that. Because when you die, you see, oh, it's a big mess. It's you with all your memories that are being folded up. I remember a woman who came to me, had high blood pressure, and she said, "I'm sick to death, afraid of dying." She said, "I don't know what it is. I can't make out why I'm so frightened of dying." That I don't think it's the pain I'm afraid of. I don't think I have any fear of what's going to happen to me after death in some sort of heaven or hell, but what is it? So we talked about this for a long time from all sorts of points of view, and finally she said, "You know, I believe what I'm afraid of is what other people are going to say. I just can't stand the thought of my funeral with all my friends around there saying, 'Well, poor old Gert, it caught up with her at last.'" Well, now, she had touched the point exactly, because it wasn't quite what people were going to say about her, but it's what people have taught you to think about death, about the disappearance of yourself, your ego, your memory system. Because with all the propaganda that's gone on to you, you must build this thing up, you know. You must be you, you must be great, you see. And then when it comes to an end, they say, "Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, you couldn't make it after all," as if you ever could. So then, we need to see death and its allied phenomena in its suchness. That is to say, well, it is just after a certain time, as the leaves in the fall disintegrate and fall off the tree, and we say, "Well, what a lovely autumn it was, this New England trees, very gorgeous season." So in the same way, human beings fall apart. And well, we say, "That's terrible." And the unanimity of the social attitude makes it terrible for each individual. But supposing the unanimity of the social attitude was quite different, and there is no reason why it shouldn't be, and falling apart is considered quite the thing to do. After all, it helps to clean things up, it gets old stuff out of the way, and so we, us, I, can all go on. We renew, we come back. And so the whole thing, you see, is this. You can't suddenly switch from death as an awful horror to death as a great event. You have to go through a certain intermediate point where you have to see it just as that. This is very useful in getting yourself accustomed to all kinds of queer things. There was a woman who's a good friend of mine who moved into the country and found her house was full of black widow spiders. Well, she was horrified. But being very sensible, she bought a book about black widows, and she got a model, those things that they sell in biological firms, a dried black widow spider encased in a plastic cube. And she got a magnifying glass, and she studied this thing. And she learned everything about black widow spiders. Finally, she captured a live one and looked at it under a magnifying glass. And slowly, 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 she appreciated the suchness of it. I mean, it's a thing that goes this way and that way, and it has things that go like this, and it bites, and it does this and that. And that's that. Well, having appreciated the suchness of it, she relieved herself of her fear. And then she learned after a while to respect them, and then really to be on very good terms with them. She knew how to keep out of their way and what their habits were. Always when she picked up a shoe, shake the shoe, don't put your foot in without shaking the shoe first. Little things like that. So somebody wrote me the other day from Santa Barbara and said that in her part of the country there are more private planes than anywhere else in the United States, and they fly at less than 1,000 feet, and they keep going over her place, and she's a very well brought up lady. She says, I'm horrified to find myself running out of doors, shaking my fist at these planes and using foul language. She said, I just can't stand them at any price. So I wrote back, I told her the story about the spiders, and said, now what you're to do is you get yourself a certain book, which I named, which is a complete photographic catalogue of all makes of private planes in the world. And you are to identify them, and every time a plane goes over, look it up in the book and see what kind it is. Go down to the airport, watch them come in and go out, get rides, and never miss one. Always get right into that plane situation. Because then this constant meow over the house, which is our, you can get with it, you see, and you can say meow. Isn't that fun? People hate drumming. Every time people start playing the conga drums, they call the police. Because there's something about that which seems threatening. They think, why, the cannibals are in the dark, they're out after us. And still you get with it yourself, you see, and you move with that, then however noisy it is, it isn't a problem any longer. But you have to see the suchness of it first, that it is just doing this kind of a bum-ba-chi-chi-bum, bum-ba-chi-chi-bum-bum, and that's that. That's what it is. And it isn't a threat, nor is it, for that matter, a promise.